Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of September. Why is it that some 12,000 Icelandic citizens signed an open letter asking to take in more asylum seekers from Syria, while Hungary fired tear gas and water cannons at refugees attempting to cross the country's southern border with Syria? Why does Donald Trump say when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best, they're sending people that have lots of problems and bringing those problems with them? They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crimes, they're rapists. While the Pope says we must not be taken aback by their numbers, but rather view them as persons, seeing their faces and listening to their stories, trying to respond as best we can to their situation. We, the people of this continent, are not fearful of foreigners because most of us once were foreigners. What are the origins of prejudice of empathy? Our guest this hour is Professor Steven Newberg. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at Arizona State University and is co-author of the study Different Emotional Reactions to Different Groups, a Sociofunctional Threat-Based Approach to Prejudice. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Steven Newberg, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it should be an interesting hour. So let me ask you the question that I started the show with. Why does Iceland say we want to take in more asylum seekers while Hungary fires tear gas and water cannons at the same people?
So I guess I would start by acknowledging the fact that all of us, whether we're from Hungary or Iceland or any place else, have these evolved systems that exist in order to identify and manage different kinds of threats, threats to resources, threats of violence, threats of disease, of threats to the way our groups work. But these different systems that exist are differentially active in different kinds of people. And so one might suggest that sort of the sort of an early, quick and dirty answer to your question is that my guess is that the people of Iceland right now, because of their economic circumstances and other kinds of features of their ecology and environment and economic circumstances, perhaps feel a little bit less vulnerable to these kind of threats than do the folks from Hungary.
Mm-hmm. And what threats are they seeing?
The folks from Hungary. So, when you think about immigrants, immigrants are sort of interesting in certain kind of ways in that they display cues to a whole bunch of different kinds of threats. So, for example, if you think about threats to resources, you know, in our communities, we exist in cooperating, coordinated groups where we do work for others, we share things, and people share back with us. One of the things that happens with immigrants is that they're coming and they haven't been part of this sort of reciprocity-based system yet, right? So when they come, they're necessarily, and this is the case for almost all immigrants, is that they're going to come and they're going to be taking more than they're giving. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's often a perception of the people who are sort of in the home ecology, the local ecology, that they're making some kind of sacrifices for other folks. And because these people aren't familiar and they haven't been part of the group, I think there's a little bit of a lack of trust that they may eventually end up pulling their own weight and contributing their fair share. So I think one of the threats has to do with threats to resources. There are also threats that relate to things that are sort of fundamental in almost a lizard brain kind of way, right? So people who aren't parts of our groups, by definition, don't really consider our welfare as much as they consider their own welfare. Of course, that's the case for us as well. And if people aren't going to be looking out for you as much as they look out for themselves, then people are concerned about threats of violence. So, for example, some of these anti-immigrant prejudices may be particularly directed towards young men from mm-hmm. out-groups, right? Because young men are particularly likely, of all groups, are more likely to be violent. And we could talk about how people from other groups as well, they have They have different cultural practices. They often practice different religions. And these kinds of things that people link to values also have implications for how they're viewed. Values are really important to groups, not because they're these abstract kind of ideas, but rather because values actually play themselves out in very tangible ways in everyday life, right? So we can think about, you know, pro-life versus pro-choice. Well, depending on what legislation looks like related to those things, those have real implications for people's lives and people's opportunities. Well, if you see someone coming from another group and you presume that they have somewhat different values than yours, then there's a little bit of concern that they're going to change the way the groups work. And values help groups, shared values, shared beliefs help groups coordinate and cooperate. And that in some ways is the essence of why we live in groups to begin with.
Well, let's center on the United States for a moment, because if you look at a lot of Europe, many of those countries are very white. They're populations that are very similar. When you look at the United States, as the Pope said, we the people of this continent are not fearful of foreigners because most of us once were foreigners. And
right.
That's in the not too distant memory of many of us. Our grandparents or our great grandparents came here. So how do you explain the anti-immigrant furor in this country that is so personified by Donald Trump?
So if we go back, I think around 10 years, you may remember, you may have the dates better than me, but prior to the Great Recession, there was actually a bipartisan effort of Republicans, Democrats working together towards comprehensive immigration reform.
Right.
In fact, two members of my own state. I'm here living in Arizona, and we're known as a pretty conservative state. We're also a border state, and yet John McCain and John Kyle back then were part of the group that was working on immigration reform. And then the recession hits. And so what happens? So the recession hits, and all of a sudden people are feeling uncomfortable about their economic futures. And you know, we talked about, you know, one of these threat management systems really having to do with managing resources. And so now the recession hits, and this system gets turned on. And one of the things that happens when these threat management systems get turned on is that they become sort of hypersensitive to threat. So think about a smoke detector. This is one of my favorite metaphors. But so a smoke detector can make two kind of mistakes, right? It can make a mistake of going off when there's no fire, or not going off when there actually is a fire. Well, if it doesn't go off when there's actually a fire, that's a really big mistake. And so at the factory, they calibrate smoke detectors such that that doesn't happen, right? So they always go off. But what that means is sometimes they go off when there's actually no fire, right? When you're cooking breakfast on a Saturday morning.
Right.
So we think about what happens now with a recession is that it calibrates our sort of smoke detectors. It calibrates our sensitivity to different kind of threats, which now means that, you know, when you think about the ideas of outsiders coming in, even though we're a nation of outsiders, right, we're so tightly, so sensitively calibrated to the possibility that that these folks are going to take some resources, that it activates the kind of emotions that that sort of fall out of this particular system, anger and resentment being predominant among them.
So when Donald Trump makes his comments, he takes it way beyond, you know, they're taking our resources. He says they're sending us people who are bringing in drugs, they're bringing crime, mm-hmm. they're rapists. What is he doing with that? Is he fueling a sentiment that's there for many, many people that's just deeply ingrained that they're more than afraid of they're taking their economic resources, although that's part of it. He's feeling another kind of fear too, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. So there's one of the fears I didn't mention earlier. I don't remember if I mentioned earlier was physical violence, and mm-hmm. we know that we have a system for managing that, and that system is. Again, because people from other groups don't really share our interests in the same kind of way, they don't necessarily have the same brakes on brakes as an automobile brakes on being aggressive against us, right? If there is a use for it or a need for it, right? I mean, and that's the case for us towards other folks as well. And so, outgroups. In particular, can activate this sort of physical safety system, and it's particularly for young outgroup men. You can think about other kinds of, and so you know what Donald Trump was doing was he was essentially you know, activating and then leveraging the activation of these of the physical safety system. And of course, that's an old strategy, right? So we can go back. So there have been demagogues throughout history. You know, Hitler talked about Jews as being vermin, right? Mm-hmm. Engaging sort of this disgust, disease-based, contamination-based system, right? In Rwanda, we had, you know, Hutu and Tutsi, and you know, with references to cockroaches, right? Again, activating a disease kind of system. You know, political entrepreneurs are quite good at activating those systems, but of course, it's easier to do when people are already somewhat concerned, and these systems are sort of already sitting at the ready.
Mm-hmm. You did a really interesting study. You had 235 European American students think about 9 different groups: activist feminists, African Americans, Asian Americans, European Americans, fundamentalist Christians, gay men, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, and non-fundamentalist Christians. And then you found, interestingly, that there were distinct prejudices existing toward different groups of people. Tell us more about that study.
Yeah, so actually we've replicated those findings tons of times now with thousands upon thousands of people in the United States and elsewhere, nationally representative samples. The idea here is that most people think about prejudice as just sort of being negativity towards groups. But from my perspective, their different groups are perceived to pose different kinds of threats. Whether they do pose those threats is a different question, but they're perceived to pose different kind of threats, and of course, different threats require different kind of responses, right? So if there's a bear running at you with teeth bared, well, you could feel sad, right? Or you could feel disgusted, you could feel angry, but those aren't going to get you away from the bear, right? So you feel fear, and fear creates a physiological system and a behavioral inclination to try to escape, right? On the other hand, you know, if you see dog poop on the sidewalk, you don't go screaming running away like you do with a bear. All you need to do is sort of avoid contact with it, and you feel disgust, which motivates that avoidance of contact. If someone cheats you, takes something from you illegitimately, you know, for you to go running away screaming in fear isn't the right response, because you don't. What you really want to do is you want to approach and get that thing back. And so when people cheat us, we feel anger, right? And that motivates sort of an approach kind of behavior. And so groups that are perceived to pose different combinations of threats should in fact be targeted by different kinds of prejudices. So some groups are targeted by disgust prejudices, others targeted by anger prejudices, others by fear prejudices. And one of the things about immigrants is that it's, in some ways, it's sort of like a perfect storm, because they have cues that suggest that people are going to feel angry by them and disgusted by them and towards at least some of them, the young men in particular, afraid of them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, reducing fear, reducing prejudice against immigrants is actually very difficult, right? Because it's sort of like whack-a-mole, right? You've got these multiple threats that these groups are often perceived to pose. And you've got to sort of simultaneously reduce all those perceptions of threat.
Hmm. Unless the face of the immigrant is a child.
Which is very interesting, right? And a child, you know, on a beach wearing little tennis little sports shoes and shorts and the like, right? Because I've been focusing here on these threat systems, but of course we have other evolved inclinations as well, and you know, empathy evolved essentially for people to help other members of their groups who are in need, and especially those who are traditionally more vulnerable. And the idea of this little kid dressed in sort of Western clothes and being a little kid, it's quite easy for that empathy mechanism to be engaged for that kid. Even though that kid isn't a member of our group, all the cues there suggest that the kid might be a member of the group. Now, if you saw the kid sort of wandering in, and instead of wearing what he was wearing, he was wearing a skull cap and he was speaking Arabic and the like, my guess is that the empathy wouldn't have been quite as powerful in reaction to to that, to
well,
that child.
How do you explain, let's look at something like the civil rights movement, and let's looking at white participation in freedom rides and voter registrations in the South, with populations of people who, if all this is true, you would think many white people would be sort of afraid of a group of people they didn't know very much about. They were not living next door to these people. Our society was highly segregated, and yet there was a profound sense of empathy when it came to that group being excluded from the mainstream of American society. So many of them risked their lives to try to get things a little more equal in this country. How do you explain that kind? I don't even know if empathy is the right word, but there is going out of your comfort zone, out of your own group, right?
Right. Empathy, in fact, is part of it. This, I think, is part of the brilliance of Martin Luther King and those who sort of adopted that kind of strategy. You know, one of the first things, so as a minister, as a preacher in a nation that's predominantly Christian, a lot of his messaging was actually religious, right? It was Christian messaging. Similar values, so presenting as similar values as opposed to having incompatible values. We might contrast in a moment with Malcolm X, for example, or Louis Farrakhan or someone like that. Not only that, it was the style of the protest was entirely peaceful, right? It wasn't aggressive, right? The protests within the context of the protests, they were victims as opposed to aggressors. If you looked at the way the young men were dressed, and I have images from way back when, dark slacks, white shirt, dark tie, right?
Yes.
Right? Again, cues that suggest nonviolence, cues that take this idea that maybe young men are going to be a little bit more aggressive and totally mute those cues and replace them with something else. I think there's brilliance in the tactics and strategies of Martin Luther King, which enabled the empathy and the notion of the shared values, right? The notion that we're all part of one country. We want the promise of the country. We're of the country. And presented in these particular kind of ways enabled the activation of the empathy. I think it was also the case that for the people who did go down and help under those circumstances, these were often people who, in fact, were reasonably well off. They had good safety nets. They came from middle class, often middle class and upper class families, and so their threat management systems weren't nearly as activated, perhaps, as some of the white folks who were living down there, who saw potential loss of resources with more black influence and power and rights. And so you had whites who were living in the South back then, and whites were different than whites who were living primarily in urban areas in the North back then, just in terms of their felt vulnerabilities. And so I think that actually played a very large role there. Whites' reactions to Malcolm X weren't nearly so favorable. Malcolm X's style was very different than Martin Luther King's style, and Malcolm X's style activated a lot of these threat management systems, and as a consequence, elicited more prejudices and more sort of behaviors designed to sort of remediate the threat that they saw out of him and his part of the movement.
The psychology of anti-immigration and anti-refugee sentiment. This hour of the program, Professor Steven Newberg is with us. He's in the Department of Psychology at Arizona State University and has done studies of prejudice all over the world. And we're going to welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Have you been struck by, it's not only in Europe with the refugees from Syria, huge numbers of people, how different countries have responded to those refugees, some with violence toward them and others saying, hey, we've got room, come on into our country, as well as what's been happening with immigrants coming from Latin America to the United States and the kind of rhetoric and the kind of actions that have been called for, building a wall, sending everybody back, or, as the Pope suggested on his trip, he may have different feelings about different groups of people, but when it comes to immigration, he said that we shouldn't be taken aback by how many there are, but see them as persons. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. In the case of the refugees from Syria, many are Muslim. We'll talk about religious differences as well with Professor Newberg to see if that's a big factor here, and some cultural factors. Which of the threats are the most important and lead to a kind of prejudice? Is it fear of physical safety? Is it a completely different culture? What is it? We'll talk about all of that as we carry on. But we'll go to you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls for Professor Steven Newberg, and we start with Denise in Amory. Hi, Denise.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
And I heard, whenever I hear Iceland, I always pipe up and pay attention because I actually lived there on two occasions, and my son is a dual citizen of Iceland.
Oh.
So I think it's very, very interesting that how such a homogenous society like Iceland, they have a national religion, their gene pool is very homogenous. The president's home is right next to the church, the national church, and I don't get how a country that is so fiercely nationalistic like that can be so accepting when a country like ours and other European nations is so closed.
And when you have a perspective, many of us don't, because most of us haven't lived in Iceland, Denise. How did you answer that for yourself when you were there? Did you find that was true on a day-to-day basis, welcoming of strangers, nice people, welcoming of everybody?
Oh, super, super European. I always tell people they're more European than the Europeans are.
So how do you explain all of this, Professor?
I wish I knew more about Iceland. In fact, now I should put that on my bucket list.
I guess we all should now.
Right. You know what? I just don't know enough about the country. I don't know how they're doing economically right now. I don't know how much space they have. There are a lot of European countries that are actually fertility rates in Europe are really quite low, far below replacement. And of course, what that means is that in order to maintain a population and to maintain an economy, especially in European countries that tend to have stronger sort of social welfare programs and responsibilities to older especially older citizens. There's actually an opportunity that comes via immigration. The United States understood it for a very long period of time, right? We had lots of resources. We had a lot of space. Let's bring in a lot of people. And, as long as they sort of, bought into the set of values in a broad sense anyway, and the principles, this was going to be really good for the nation. You could think about parts of Western Europe where fertility rates are so low that an influx of people, especially folks who are educated, and I believe the Syrian refugees tend to be more on the educated side, the ones who've been able to get out and have the money to get out and all, provides a great possible opportunity for a country. And so I just don't know enough about Iceland to know whether it's really something that has to do with sort of the culture per se and the set of norms, whether it has to do with circumstances that they're doing well enough that it's easier for them to focus on opportunities as opposed to the threats. I just don't have a good answer for you. We need a political science scientist here, maybe.
Yeah, well, we need somebody who knows about Iceland. I don't know if we get a lot of listeners on that show, but I'd be interested in a show about what's going on in Iceland. I do recall they had a huge banking crisis not that long ago. Remember that? And I'm sure people were hurting then, so they must have turned it around some. Denise, thank you so much for your call, and we'll learn more about Iceland. Joshua in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, earlier when you were talking about how sometimes the response is different in the immigration area when the faith of the child, why that didn't correlate with more sympathy for all the South American and Central American children that came through in Texas like a year or so ago when we were having that large influx.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, so... You know, what people respond to are, they don't respond so much to abstractions, they respond to cues. And that, you know, the photo of the Syrian kid on the beach, I mean, I think an awful lot of people saw that. You know, I don't know, but I don't remember seeing photos of these young kids coming up from, you know, Central and South America up across the border. I mean, I think they were quickly moved into different kind of detention centers and the like. And the mind isn't really designed to deal with sort of abstractions and statistics, right? I mean, those are all sort of very modern technologies, modern inventions, right? The mind, which has evolved over millions of years. Millions and millions of years has evolved in terms of seeing things directly in front of them. I think another aspect of that might be that the physical condition of meaning what folks were wearing, whether they look clean, and all those types of things look a lot different when people have been coming up through South and Central America and Mexico and through the deserts and finally show up, right? I mean, anyone who sort of makes that kind of journey is going to look disheveled and dirty and the like, and of course those are cues that activate different kind of disgust systems that we have as well. I think it also happened within this context of this huge debate. I think there are an awful lot of people in America who felt tons of empathy for these kids, and in fact feel tons of empathy for folks who are coming up across the border. Right? I believe the majority of Americans actually want comprehensive immigration reform. I think the majority of Americans actually, I mean, I think the data show this, would be absolutely fine with guest worker programs and with programs for people who are already here to become legalized here and citizens as well. We often hear the people who are at the extremes and the people who are loudest at the extremes, and typically the people who are loudest are the people who are perceiving threats as opposed to people who are perceiving opportunities. And so I think the American population is actually way more mixed on this. Policy may be one thing, but I think in terms of the typical American reaction, I'm not sure that given seeing the similar kind of thing as we saw with that child on the beach, that the typical American wouldn't, in fact, feel very similarly.
Thank you, Joshua, for your call. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655, and we have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. You have talked, Professor, about a need to create different interventions to reduce inappropriate prejudices against different groups. What kind of interventions are you thinking about?
Well, so if we're thinking about this, when we think about immigration, because immigrants are often seen to pose a bunch of different kind of threats, you would need to focus on different kind of things. But let me make a more general statement first. Right, I've been talking a lot about these threat systems, but there are also these opportunity systems. Right, I mean the fact is. We do engage with people from different groups. I mean, across our evolutionary history, if all we did was stay with our little group, we probably wouldn't be here in very good shape because inbreeding is a problem, right?
Right.
And so people did have familiarity with moving to different groups. For humans, especially women, moving to different groups, which may be one explanation for how women tend to be less prejudiced against ethnic outgroups than men do and men are in general. But we do have familiarity with moving to other groups, and we do so on, and interact with them under different circumstances, right? We trade with other groups, right? And so there are systems that that allow not just for xenophobia, which is sort of what we've been talking about, but something that one might call xenophilia, right? Times in which members from other groups would actually be highly valued, and maybe even under some circumstances, more valued. And so, you know, one set of interventions, and you know, I've seen this in some public statements, for example, out of Germany, if my recollection is correct, where people are trying to focus on opportunities, right? So you have economists talking about, yes, in the short term it costs us more, it costs us to bring these people in. In the long term, if they settle here, in fact, this is a moneymaker for us, right? It's going to improve our economic status because you're bringing in people who want to contribute, and you bring in young people who want to contribute, and you get synergies out of that, and you get economic strengths. And so, to the extent that that one can focus on opportunities instead of threats, and in fact, even in our country. We do that. There are all sorts of business groups out there that that bemoan the fact that we don't have more more flexible and open immigration systems, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the opportunities they see. Now, the thing is, it's hard to see opportunities, right, when the threats are so salient, because we're risk averse, right? We focus, we want to protect ourselves against the worst error. What's the worst error? To be overrun by people who we we've got this idea that they're going to change the society and pull resources out of it. So to make that mistake, or to make the mistake of missing out on some opportunities that could be great sometime in the future. And, you know, people are present focused and they're threat focused. And so it's hard sometimes to engage that opportunity psychology. I think as economics get better, I think we're going to see in this country, I'd be surprised if we don't see something that looks like comprehensive immigration reform within the next 4 or 5 years, maybe earlier. In Europe, you know, you see that Germany is accepting folks way more enthusiastically than a lot of other countries. Well, Germany is also doing better economically than these other countries.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what role, because some of what you write about is evolution and how evolution may have prepared our minds to be prejudiced. How long does that revolutionary thing last with us?
So think about what evolution does is it gives us a set of tools, but they're not... You know, a lot of people have views of evolution that there's this biological determinism to them, that if you have this inclination, it's there and it's really, really hard to change. But what evolution actually does is it gives us these functionally flexible tools. So, for example, fear is an evolved emotion. Not only do humans have it, but most critters have something that looks an awful lot like fear. In fact, if you look at the biology and the physiology of it, it looks very similar in other kind of mammals and other mammals. So it's clearly something that's evolved. Yet you right now are not afraid, and I right now am not afraid, and most of your listeners right now are not afraid. And the reason that we're not afraid is because the cues out there to suggest danger just aren't present for us in this moment, right? It could be that 2 hours from now, when you're out on the street, something's going to happen, and all of a sudden you'll be afraid. But the idea here is that what's evolved isn't the fact that we're afraid all the time. What's evolved is this system that's highly sensitive to cues out there in the environment that say, ah, now is the time that one should be afraid. But there are also cues out there that says now is the time that we ought to be empathic, right? Mm-hmm. Now is the time that we ought to be enthusiastic. Right, and so you've got these different systems, and they're what we call functionally flexible. They get turned on under some circumstances. They get turned off under other circumstances. What this means is that there's actually a lot of opportunity for sort of environmental control and social control, right? Because if you can alter features of the environment, or if you can alter what people get exposed to in terms of the cues that they have, or if you can alter which cues count for them as, you know, as suggesting that people are members of the out-group as opposed to members of the in-group, you can really push around people's reaction to other folks. So sometimes, you know, this idea of biological determinism, when people think about think about evolution. That's just not true. There's no evolutionist who believes in biological determinism. In fact, what there is there's an awful lot of flexibility, and that understanding that flexibility actually gives people who want to make change a lot of power.
Interesting. Here's a comment on our webpage. The reasons why many Americans are leery of today's immigrants, even though we all come from immigrants, is because immigrants of the past wanted to become Americans. They wanted to assimilate and be part of one nation, to learn the language, customs, follow our laws. Today, that does not seem to be true.
So what this what this emailer is getting at, I think, is very important. When you think about So we can go back into the early 1800s when the Irish came to the United States, and the views of the Irish back then were as bad as the views towards any ethnic group that came to the United States.
No Irish need apply.
Huh?
No Irish need apply.
That's exactly right. And yet, if you ask now about how people think about the Irish, there's no sort of negative prejudice out there. There may be still some stereotypes, but in fact, the stereotypes are actually a little flattering in a funny kind of way. Yeah, they like to drink, and every once in a while they get into these bar fights, right? And that's boys being boys kind of thing, right? I mean, you don't have the same kind of negativity. It's changed entirely. And the question is, why has it changed entirely? And I think what your writer would suggest, and what I think the data would suggest, is that what the Irish have done is that they've, in fact, now they emit cues, they act in kinds of ways that are the ways of the in-group, right? And so when a writer says that, and people think that, immigrants nowadays don't want to essentially adopt American values, that would be something that would be seen as a threat. And so one of the things I find very interesting is the role of language in all of this.
Yes.
Because language, from an evolutionary perspective, we never would have come across people who were ethnically different than us or racially different than us. We just didn't roam that far away, right? That's been very recent when we come across people who would really fundamentally look different than us. On the other hand, people that live not very far away could have very different kind of dialects from one another. And language would have been a very, very good cue for identifying someone as being a member of your group or a member of another group. In fact, if you live in New York City even now, right, people there from Queens can tell whether you're from this part of Queens or that part of Queens or whether you're from Brooklyn or the Bronx or whatever,
yes.
Manhattan, right? And so language is a very, very powerful cue. And I think one of the interesting issues is that to the extent that people maintain their home languages instead of adopting the new languages, that's going to be a cue in the minds of the current residents, the people of the place that they're coming to. That's just going to be a very natural cue that says, this person's from the outgroup. And what I was going to say is that now that's sort of an interesting dilemma, right? Because one might say, well, it's, why should people have to give up their culture and their heritage and their practices and their language and all of that? That's not fair. And that, from my perspective, I'll bring my values into it for this part of the conversation. No, that's not fair. On the other hand, there also is a reality there. There's an is there. The mind is sort of attuned to different language and using that as information to make guesses about whether that person's going to be as invested in you as they are going to be in other people who speak that language. So there's a trade-off there. So if you come to this country and you want to maintain your customs and your language and you want to live among the people from where you're from, right, in an ethnic neighborhood, say, one of the benefits is, you're an American and you can do that, and one of the benefits is you're maintaining a connection to your roots, and there's a lot great about that. But one of the costs is, one of the trade-offs is that people are going to view you with suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to decide what one wants to do, right? My grandparents were immigrants, and they made a decision that my son wasn't really going to learn their home language, that they were going to learn English really fast and as best as they could, and their son was going to get exposed to the English, and they really tried to minimize the speaking of German. In the household, that was the trade-off that they made. They were willing to give up some things, right, in order to gain other kind of things. Mm-hmm.
More phone calls in a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're trying to understand psychologically what's going on with our different reactions to the refugees from Syria, to immigrants who are trying to come to the United States. What is it that creates fear, anger, people upset about this? And on the other hand, some people are welcoming these people with open arms. So what is it that's going on in our minds? What do we see when we see refugees? What prejudices are in our minds that have been there for a long, long period of time? What is it that we do to change our emotional reactions to different groups? That's what's on the table this hour. Professor Steven Newberg is our guest. He's a professor of psychology at Arizona State University and has done many studies all over the world on these very issues. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Sarah in Lake Zurich, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. Hi, Professor. I'm thinking about why people do what they do and about social psychology studies, which it seems to me that like they make generalizations about how all people, I mean, sometimes I see, it seems to me that they make generalizations about how all people will follow outside influences, sort of like monolith, like in mass. And yet there's always like a 30 or 40% of people who don't do that. And like, for example, well, you were saying how Germany, you know, people responded in Germany during the Nazi period for certain reasons. But, you know, Hitler was elected with, what, 45% of the vote, and then he stayed in power because of tyranny after that. And like in the middle from experiment, you know, there were a bunch of people who didn't shock, and then there's people who did see the gorilla. And so why do people, why is there this big chunk of variation of, you know, personal variation? And then, okay, so I was asking an old Holocaust researcher why some people saved Jews and other people didn't. And he said, you know, I wanted to know that question too, so I started asking people, and they said, well, it was because my parents taught me that I should always try to, you know, help other people. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I feel like, you know, family upbringing has so much to do with how people behave and also whether, you know, whether a kid gets the, you know, the parenting that they need, that has so much to do with it. So I don't know. There's just so many things going on, and I just wish you'd address all that variation.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay. It's a great question, Sarah. And one of the things I think my recollection of some of the data in terms of the Nazis was that parents who happened to have people, you know, in the house coming to dinner who were from different groups, those children who saw that were especially likely to be more open to the stranger. I've talked so far about vulnerability that people feel because of, you know, sort of changes in the environment and the situation, right? Economic vulnerability, for example, that comes out of a recession. But you can also think that people are have individual differences in their felt vulnerabilities, and there's a lot of research on this now. My colleague Mark Schaller at the University of British Columbia and others have really done a lot of really good work looking at these individual differences. Some people, so if you're thinking about the immigration idea. Some people are just more dialed, more chronically concerned with physical safety violence. And we could talk about why that might be. As with most individual differences, part of it is genetic and part of it is environmental, and they sort of work together in complex kind of ways. But people differ in their vulnerability to their felt vulnerability to physical safety threats. People differ widely in their felt vulnerability of catching diseases and becoming sick. People differ in their vulnerability to sort of having a lack of resources. And people feel, you know, there are differences in the extent to which people feel vulnerable that their groups are going to decay, you know, when people with different values or apparently different values come in. And so what we find in most of the research is that these kind of really strong prejudice effects are especially likely for people who are towards the end, that they dispositionally feel a little bit more vulnerable. And they're now confronting situations that make that vulnerability real. So, for example, one of Professor Schaller's studies puts people in a dark room and then sort of looks at their thoughts that they – a dark versus a well-lit room – and then sort of looks at their automatic thoughts to people of different ethnic outgroups. And what he finds is that for people who already have a little bit of a felt vulnerability to violence – and now they're doing the study in a dark room as opposed to a well-lit room, they're the people who are especially likely to show danger-related prejudices, stereotypes, and prejudices. They've done other studies that show, for example, that people who view themselves as especially likely to be vulnerable to disease, these people, when you put them in a situation where they're let to think about disease, and where you show them people who look sort of diseased, those people are especially likely now to be expressing disease-based kinds of prejudices, prejudice against people who are physically abnormal in certain kind of ways, people who in fact are subjectively foreign to them. So you make a really important point that the findings I'm talking about, the systems that I'm talking about, are differentially activated and engaged depending on individual differences and how vulnerable people feel to the particular threats.
Thank you, Sarah. Linda in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to add a comment to the professor's observation that maybe some of the differences into why some immigrants get accepted and some don't. I want to add to not only the language, but that I think the color of skin, in my opinion, has a lot to do with it as well.
Linda, you're entirely right. Color of skin can sort of serve as a mega cue of someone who's different than you, right? But it's not just skin. You can think about people who have very different kinds of body types and facial shapes and the like, and they tend to engage that same kind of psychology of perceiving someone as if they're from another group. You can think about other features as well. People who come from different places, they eat different foods and use different spices, and because of that, they smell differently, right? So people who smell different from us, not having anything to do with hygiene per se, right? But they smell differently because they eat different kind of foods. That also suggests that people are from an outgroup, and then therefore engages these kinds of processes. That said, you know, those kind of characteristics, especially skin color, isn't something that would have evolved per se. That is, it's very unlikely that race per se is something that the human mind is attuned to, sort of in the same way that we're attuned to, for example, people's sex or gender or people's age. Because, again, we didn't have a lot of contact with people who looked racially different than us until very, very recent in our evolutionary history.
We all came out of Africa, right?
Huh?
We all came out of Africa.
We did, a very, very long time ago. But then once people sort of settled in different places, I mean, think about, let's say humans would have wandered maybe, you know, a couple hundred miles in their lifetime as they move from place to place. People who sort of came from, who are living in places a couple hundred miles apart probably look pretty similar to one another. Right, if you were living in what now is Western Europe, it would have been a very long time once people were there and settled, that they would have seen people who looked stunningly different than them, would have looked pretty similar. So race per se probably isn't one of those fundamental cues, which means that it can be more readily be overridden by other kind of characteristics. So in the United States, African Americans are targeted for more prejudices, for example, than Caribbean Americans.
Right.
There's a different history of how folks got here. Right. They both have similar coloring. Right. Or you can think about people who emigrate from Nigeria or whatever. Right. Similar coloring, but they're here for different reasons. They've lived under different kind of circumstances. They display other kinds of cues that are seen in this country anyway as perhaps being somewhat less threatening.
Thanks, Linda. We have time for one more call. We're almost out of time. Melinda in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi. Hi, I've been listening to the show for a while, and I listen to public radio all the time. And I've called in before, but usually not quite as angry as I am right now, because I am very offended by the expert. I feel like he's pinning everything on racism and calling people racist and prejudiced and things that don't think that we need a bunch of more immigrants here right now. I think it boils down to resources. We're not taking care of people that we have here. We do not need to bring hundreds of thousands of other people here and not take care of our veterans, kids in foster care, and other people like that that we need to be working on in our own place and become healthy so that we can help other people. And I'll take my
call. All right, thanks. We have about 15 seconds, Professor. That's all.
Okay, so really quickly, Melinda, I'm not talking about the aughts. I'm not making value judgments about people's reactions. I'm talking about what the natural reactions are, what we might expect to have. Whether those are seen as good or bad, that depends on our value systems, right? And of course, with politics, some people will agree with you and some will disagree. But I'm just talking about what the natural systems are and how they work.
Thank you, Professor Newberg, very much. Professor Steven Newberg, Professor of Psychology at Arizona State University. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, to Scott Myers for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your very interesting calls. News coming up, and we'll return.